from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation from the archives with the author Douglas Glover about his book, Attack of the Copula Spiders, Essays on Writing, which was published by Biblioasis. The Wall Street Journal has called Douglas Glover a master of narrative structure. His latest book is a collection of short stories called Savage Love. He has published 6 books of short stories, 4 novels, 2 essay collections, and The Enamored Knight, a book about Cervantes and novel form. His novel L won the 2003 Governor General's Award for Fiction. In 2007, he received the Writers' Trust Timothy Findley Award. His stories have been frequently anthologized, notably in the Best American Short Stories, Best Canadian Stories, and the new Oxford Book of Canadian Stories. His criticism has appeared in The Globe and Mail, The New York Times Book Review, Washington Post, Book World, Boston Globe Books, and the Los Angeles Times. From 1996 to 2006, he was the editor of the annual collection Best Canadian Stories. He teaches in the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Writing program. In 2010, he founded the online magazine Numero 5. In the tradition of E.M. Forrester, John Gardner, and James Wood, Douglas Glover has produced a book on writing at once erudite, anecdotal, instructive, and amusing. That is from the description of Attack of the Copula Spiders, which represents the accumulated wisdom of a remarkable literary career. Novelist, short story writer, essayist, teacher, and mentor, Douglas Glover has for decades been asking the vital questions: how does the way we read influence the way we write? What do craft books fail to teach aspiring writers about theme, about plot and subplot, about constructing point of view? How can we maintain drama on the level of the sentence and explain drama in the sentences of others? What is the relationship of form and art? How do you make words live? Whether his subject is Alice Munro, Cervantes, or the creative writing classroom, Glover's take is frank and fresh, demonstrating again and again that graceful writers must first be strong readers. The collection is a call to arms for all lovers of English, and Attack of the Copula Spiders is our best defense against the assaults of a post-literate age. When I spoke with Doug Glover in 2012, I asked him to begin by reading from this essay collection. I gave him a series of page numbers to read from, and then suggested that we talk about his assertion in the book that we are in an age of post-literacy. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
At the beginning of Don Quixote, the old Don, Alonso the Good, goes insane from reading books, jumps into a rusty suit of armor, and dashes off on his nag, Rocinante, in the name of an imaginary lady, Dulcinea del Toboso. In an effort to cure him, his friends, the curate and the barber, sort through his books, burn some of them, and brick up the library doorway to conceal the rest. They tell Quixote that an evil necromancer has done the brickwork. Because he lives in a book, he believes them. In Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, Sir Thomas Bertram has to leave home for Antigua to manage his plantations. While he's away, his children and their airheaded friends decide to put on a play, the reading of which unleashes a storm of libidinal indiscretion. Arriving just in time, Sir Thomas gathers all the copies of the play and burns them. In Ray Bradbury's science fiction novel Fahrenheit 451, Bradbury imagines an upside-down world in which all books have been banned and the fire department exists for the sole purpose of finding and burning books. The novel's hero, Montag, discovers an underground movement where people memorize books, then destroy them. In order to preserve books from the book burners, they become the books. But, chillingly, as a character in the book tells Montag, it's not as if the book bans and the firemen were necessary. The public itself stopped reading of its own accord. Books used to be seen as a threat, as dangerous articles capable of corrupting morals or inspiring passionate love, igniting revolutions, or sowing, variously, liberty, disorder, and oppression. Books had to be watched, banned, proscribed, listed, condemned, and bowdlerized. Ulysses and Lady Chatterley's Lover were put on trial. Henry Miller's work was banned in the United States. But not anymore. Not now. No need to burn or memorize or smuggle books because, in fact, nobody reads them anyway. School boards routinely and quietly choose what classics our children can't read, and nobody cares. English departments study the sociology of texts and excommunicate great works from the canon because they were written by authors of the wrong race and gender, and everyone nods with approval. Because books have become irrelevant, we live in an age of post-literacy, what B.W. Pow defines as the condition of semi-literacy, where most people can read and write to some extent, but where the literate sensibility no longer occupies a central position in culture, society, and politics. Post-literacy occurs when the ability to comprehend the word decays. For most of my life, I've been in denial about post-literacy, blaming local conditions or my own myriad insufficiencies for anomalies that now appear systemic rather than incidental. Teaching itself helped mask the true conditions and contradictions. I have been teaching creative writing and occasionally English literature for a dozen years, and I really thought that all those writing students valued books, language, writing, and writers. If they didn't, I told myself, they would after I was finished with them. But over the years, it has been borne in on me that this is not true. As I write, we, both in Canada and the United States, are in the midst of a sudden and astonishing proliferation of second-generation low-residency Master of Fine Arts writing programs, which themselves are a sort of third-generation elaboration of the old-fashioned Iowa Writers' Workshop-style residential Master of Fine Arts programs. Now more than ever, it is possible to get a doctorate in creative writing, and it is possible to get degrees in nonfiction writing, editing, playwriting, and screenwriting. And sad to say, it is possible to obtain any one of these degrees without writing a publishable sentence, paragraph, story, novel, or essay.
Thank you very much. That was Douglas Glover reading from Attack of the Copula Spiders, published by Biblioasis. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit and find out two things. First of all, what has replaced books in the public interest of literacy, if anything? And what drives people toward MFAs if they aren't interested in books? Or am I muddling that?
No, I those are interesting questions. First of all, when I wrote that, I'm writing out of a rhetorical context. I am trying to make people sit up, and it's a dialectical statement meant to elicit a response and yes. And some thought. So,
which is why I flagged it and said, "Hey,
right.
Doug, talk about this."
Right, and it's near the beginning of the book. In many ways, it's a book about how to read. So it's challenging people to look at this and sort of say, here's a way of reading more deeply. It's a way of reading that's not based on what we learn in high school and college, which is a kind of interpretive stance towards mm-hmm. literature. It's more of an analytical, structural, technical stance that actually, to me, illuminates texts in a far better way. But then your questions still obtain. What has replaced books? Well, oddly enough, statistically, there are a lot of books being sold right now.
Yeah.
And so that looks like it denies what I'm saying. But a lot of those are kind of, more and more of those are kind of very hastily published e-books. I mean, e-book singles. Any person can now publish a book and with a couple of $100.
Right.
And actually can appear on Amazon. And then there are huge numbers of hack publicists who will pump your book for you over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so there's an amazing amount of books coming out that probably aren't worth reading.
Right.
But then in the culture at large, in a sense, what's replaced books is the fact that you, in many ways, we read the culture, and the culture is a lot of words coming at us, strange fragments of words coming through advertising and through television and through the internet. So we're still actually reading in a funny way, but it's it is a kind of illiterate reading because it's meant to sell. It has one sort of message, and it creates a kind of fuzzy alertness mm-hmm. or anxiety, which is very unlike real reading
lose yourself in.
Well, where actually, yeah, and in a sense, reading a book focuses you and concentrates you and calms you down. I don't know if you experienced this, but when my kids were very young, the way to get them to go to sleep was to read to them.
Oh,
not
absolutely.
Because books are boring.
No.
But because they calm down the chatter of the world. So what's replaced books is chatter.
Okay.
It's my mind. Okay.
Yeah. Which is not
It's not
calming.
The same. It's not calming. It's not deep.
Yeah. It's not reflective. So I'm not being stupid about that. I know there are a lot of things that's still being published, and there are a lot of words, and we have mass education. Everybody knows how to read up to a point. But it's that, it's a kind of qualitative experience of a book that's starting to be missed. And saying that, I'm not opposed to e-books either. I mean, I'll read Don Quixote as an e-book. That's not a problem.
Right, right.
It's a certain kind of literary experience that's being lost.
And then the other side of the question is the MFAs, and I'm curious what you think. Now, obviously, you teach in an MFA program. I have my MFA. We know each other through that program.
I have an MFA.
You have an MFA. A lot of people with MFAs go on to do wonderful things.
Sure.
So the impetus to get an MFA, though, and the proliferation of the programs, I'm curious what your take is on that.
Well, I think my take is it's pretty much the way everybody else. I mean, I think you sit and puzzle about what your experience is, and why here I am in 2012, and suddenly there, within the last 15 to 20 years, just a huge explosion of MFA and writing programs,
right.
And PhD and writing, doctorate and writing programs growing
right.
more and more. And you say, what's going on? And I'm lucky, it helps pay the bills,
yeah.
But why is this going on? And how much good does it do people? And I think that, you know, it's almost facetious because I sort of mentioned it there. It's a little bit like what learning to play the piano for a well-brought-up young woman was at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, everybody learned to do some art up to a point. It's a kind of social marker for a kind of cultural adeptness in some way or other. It means that you're in the world in some way, you're participating. That's part of it, I think. But other than that, I'm not really quite sure. I mean, I could speculate that maybe there is some yearning for a bookish experience that, mm-hmm. that we're not getting.
Mm-hmm.
Why that would lead you to want to write instead of sit down and read, I don't know.
Right.
There is also still, I mean, we're oddly enough kind of very late Victorians. Like, we still have that Victorian romantic sensibility about the artist. You yearn to make your life an adventure, and so becoming an artist of some sort seems still sort of adventurous, even though if you really looked at me as a writer, it would not be very adventurous in real life. I'm a living example of the non-adventurousness of writing. I don't know, all those reasons. Having said that, I just still think it's a puzzle. It really is a puzzle to me why there are so many programs and so many people. I mean, one reason there are so many programs is it's just that's greed on the part of institutions, because they just see, okay, here's a cash cow.
Yeah.
And so one of the reasons for the proliferation of programs, some of which are really not very helpful, is that the institutions just want to make some money. I do want to also say, I mean, I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which is what the old-fashioned residential model, where most of the teaching was done through workshops with your peers. And then I teach in the Vermont College of Fine Arts, which is the low residency model, and really one of the originators of that model. And I have to say that as a teacher, I feel more ethically satisfied teaching in a program like this than I would if I was teaching in a residential program. And I have taught undergraduates in residential and even graduates in residential programs with that workshop model. And I just feel that I have a much more correct relationship with my students here than I would if I was concentrating in a workshop situation, because workshops are mostly crowd control issues, whereas if I'm working as a mentor one-on-one, I can really, the opportunity is there to really teach a student something about writing.
Right.
So I like teaching, and I think this is the best chance to learn how to write in a program like this.
And it is interesting. It does seem like there's a craving on the part of the public for an education in the arts. I mean, I heard a statistic recently on Bill Maher where he was talking about, he was actually sort of criticizing this, but there are, I think, a third as many people studying math and engineering and things like that than there are people studying the arts, which is interesting.
It's very interesting, and it's peculiar.
It is odd, yeah. Okay, let's talk about globs, which is your term. Can you talk about what globs are?
Well, you know, when I was a beginning writer, I was reading some of the how-to books, and in those days, and I think to some extent they still do it, the way of talking about it was to divide narrative into scene and summary. Scene, summary, and description often. And scene is where people are acting and talking on the stage, basically. And in summary is where time is compressed and things happen over our general descriptions of events. So then I started writing that way. I found one man who said, you know, you have to plan this out ahead, where you're, what you're going to put in scene and what you're going to put in summary. So then I started to write that way, and it was just, you know, awful, turgid, slow-moving junk. And so I began to look at real literature, which is what you should always do. And what I noticed was that really good writers, the only way you can describe it is that there's always a dance of time going on. Mm-hmm. That you don't have a chunk of summary. You might have a little bit of summary and then a little bit of scene. You might have a scene snippet. You might have a scene that's only a line of dialogue stuck in the middle of a paragraph. That's a scene. And then there might be summary, or there might be backfill, and there might be backfill, and then a little more backfill, a little more backfill. How can you what's a useful way of describing how narrative works so that it can be useful to me? I looked and looked, and what I began to see was that the way narrative really moves forward is in fairly discrete chunks of text based on time switches. That is, one day something happens, and then 2 days later something happens. 4 years ago I was doing this. Mm-hmm. You start to sort of see that really good writing is very much organized that way. And each chunk takes place in a relatively discrete period of time. Although, when you really look, good writers are then doing, within that chunk, often smaller and smaller chunks. And you start to see time structures that are very interesting. You see loops and all kinds of strange dances. Anyway, so I sort of, you know, make up facetious names for things, but I said, okay, I call that a chunk, a glob, and then a text. A narrative text is made out of a series of globs, some of which will be, the time flow will be varied. But it will be organized like this. What you find with student writing, of course, is that they forget to put the time switches in, and so nothing then is organized relative to other elements in the text. The time switches tell the reader when this is relative to the other events of the story. If you're not careful with that, then, of course, you can't, A, concentrate a lot of bits of time, and you lose a certain textual density, and you also lose the ability to play with time.
Right.
Okay.
I remember one thing that you said once when I was listening to you speak, was that within a glob, perhaps you might, and maybe you're going to get to this, but just so I mention it, that you might have somebody think about something else or remember something, have a little flashback moment. And it was really helpful to me that you talked about anchoring that moment in time and coming back to that. I don't know if you called it an anchor, by like the dog was barking, and then the dog is still barking,
right,
and
no,
that brings you back into the moment.
No, that's that. Once you start sort of seeing these time switches and globs, okay, then you start to sort of see all kinds of other time devices
are happening within.
Right, and what you begin to see is that you can, any narrative has what I would call a baseline chronology, which is, if you read a short story, what you look at, or you read a memoir, it doesn't matter, it can be nonfiction, but what is the earliest thing mentioned in the text? It could be in the backfill, you know. And what is the last thing mentioned in the text? And that, and the basic chronology of the text is from the beginning point to the end point. And then the author may just pick a certain segment of that to dramatize. Then you have all this other time that you can kind of play in. Mm-hmm. And so you can do, oh, there's lovely things. There's beautiful then-now construction, which is, you see writers doing it. Once you start to see it, see writers doing it all the time. So that would be one glob, and it would be a bifurcated glob, which says, then the street, you know, was empty of houses. The pioneers hadn't come yet. And now it's 35 high-rises. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that's a stupid illustration. But what you've done is you've compressed 100 years of time in a sentence, and you've told a story about the development of the social life, the architecture, and so forth, in a very concentrated space. You've told it in a kind of dramatic fashion because you've contrasted a picture of one time with a picture of another time. And that's a beautiful little chunk of material, and a kind of dense chunk of meaning. Mm-hmm. And so, and things. Then the thing that you mentioned There's different things. There's one I call the nested glob, where you have a scene, and then you jump out and put in a piece of backfill or another scene, and then come back to the original scene. That's defined. That's a nested glob.
Right.
You have to understand that I'm facetious in my naming.
These terms, but that's all right. They need to be called something.
Right. And then maybe they are called something by somebody else. You know, narratologists have names for a lot of things that I haven't memorized.
But they're narratologists,
right,
which is not anything anybody else ever thought of being.
No. Don't put down narratologists. They're fine people, and I read them. And I'll learn from them. And then there's a running, you can have syncopation, where you have a glob, and then you mention it again and again as the text goes down. And that can be, you call that a running glob, or you can call it a syncopated glob.
Okay.
And suddenly the time, and again, all these things are only work if you're very, very careful about telling the reader each time you move how the time has changed. And it's a really crucial element of writing, it seems to me. So, and I invented the word glob. The other thing about globs is that it can be modular. Once you see them that way, then you can sort of take one out and put it somewhere else in the text.
Okay.
Because so you can arrange the kind of emotional intensity or density, textual density. You can repeat globs.
Right. Is there, in your own mind, is there a length that a glob can be before it gets too long?
No.
Or too short?
No, absolutely not. But that's a very good question, because that speaks to pace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one of the things that, if you start reading a text for globs, you'll start to notice that you can have a slow-paced piece of writing, which the globs are longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then a speedier pace of writing, the globs are shorter. That's the rule of thumb.
Okay.
And then that means you can, if you're writing a text, okay, and you have your globs are running at a roughly similar, you know, size and pace, and then you have a really long chunk, then you look at that and you say, well, there's probably something wrong with that. And I can break that up to keep the pace correct. There is also a technique called progression de fait. It's the French word for it, which is that you, and it's not, people don't sort of think about it very much, but you still see writers using it, which is to shorten the globs as you move towards your climax.
Mm.
So that you actually speed up the pace of the text as you move towards the end.
Say it again.
Progression.
Oh,
progression
de
fait.
Okay.
Progression of effect.
Of effect. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What you just said about time. Do you feel that a text is best represented in chronological order? Do you have a problem when things go out of order, or do you just want it all identified so people know where they're at?
No, it's more a matter of identifying the text.
Okay. So Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, which goes all out of order. I don't know if you read that book, but you know, it goes all out of order, but she's always very clear about what
right.
the time period
no,
is.
No, this is, in fact, the delight is actually to play with time. So the more complex and dense, densely written, densely presented a bunch of times are, the more exciting the text is.
Okay.
The only critical thing is that you say when things happen. For the lecture, I have this analysis of the first few lines of Proust's Remembrance of Things Past.
Okay.
And there's an overture. It's like with the guys waking up in bed. And I counted the words, right?
That's with the Madeleine, right? He's eating the...
No, that's not. At first he's talking about sleeping.
Up. Okay.
He's talking about sleeping.
Okay.
Half being half awake and half not awake, and time is moving around. And there was something like, okay, I'm going to just guesstimate because I don't have the figures. Something like 340 words of text that I had in, and I think 140 of them were time words, which shows you how consciously and carefully he was controlling the time of the passage. All that's happening on the page is the guy is talking about half being asleep and half not sleeping and what he's half dreaming in.
Right.
But the time is, and of course the word time repeats at least I think 5 times in that text.
Wow. Okay.
And of course that book is about time and memory, so you would say of course he's doing that. But then if you look at almost any other text, well-written text, you begin to see the same kinds of numbers of time words. Extraordinary number.
When he repeats the word time over and over and over within this 300 plus
word,
does that become annoying?
No.
Or you don't notice it at all?
Well, I think that the...
I mean, you're looking for it. You're looking at it.
Right. I don't think the normal reader would tend to notice it. But they should. I mean, part of the lesson of the book Copula Spiders is that you will read the book better if you begin to notice that this is... this sort of structure is happening.
Right.
He is telling you what's important about his huge book.
Yeah.
And it's a vast book, and it's about time, and he controls time throughout it. It would be meaningless without the... That other thing about time, if you don't understand the time, the reader is not allowed to understand the time structure of the piece, then that speaks also to character and motive. Because motive is causality. Causality is sequence. Sequence is time. If you don't know the sequence of the events in the text, you can't deduce the motivation of one leading to the other. I mean, if you don't... So that all these things... Time is just immensely important. Unfortunately, all this talk about, most of this talk, there's some stuff about globs in this book, but I'm actually going to write another essay about time.
I just think the glob thing is fascinating and really helpful.
You know, it's to me, personally, as a writer, it seems like, to me, that was the first really big discovery I made for myself about writing. Huh. And it's energized so much of what I do.
I find it so challenging as a writer to transition well between what I, you know, now I'm thinking of as globs of text.
Right.
And I think that's really helpful to know how to look at it and think about it and read other books.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big thing is to read other books and see how, in fact, people do it.
Well, we just talked about repeating the word time in a certain passage. So this is a quote from your book, Attack of the Copula Spiders. Repetition is the heart of narrative art, and if you don't read texts with a pencil and note the repetitions, there's no way you'll learn how they work. So what sorts of things do you encourage your students to learn to mark? And, you know, word repetitions, phrases, images, I'm guessing that that's what you're referring to. But can you talk about using repetition in fiction and also using it without allowing it to become dull or predictable?
Well, first of all, when I say read and look for these things, I don't just mean repetition. In fact, if I'm working with a student, I give that student a reading rubric.
And I should point out that that's not the first time in the book that you mention reading with a pencil. And
right.
So you're reiterating what you've said before, and this is one of the things that they should look for.
And actually, I stole that from, I mean, if Virginia Woolf says in her diary somewhere, she doesn't know how people can read without a pencil. But it just goes without saying. So, and my sons, by the way, can tell when I've been reading a book, because the first thing I do, as I read now, I circle all the but words. Because that's kind of a crucial, that's in the...
That but construction,
the essay,
that's my next question.
The essay in the the drama of grammar. They say, oh, Dad, you've been reading this one. Just read it once, have you? Because it's only the but.
So you can't give your books away, or you can't...
Oh, no.
You can't, like, sell them to the used bookstores or anything.
No. But they might be collector's items someday. But we're talking about globs. I mean, I read a text, I'm drawing the lines through the text. I'm a globbing line, so I do the rough globbing. Where are the major breaks in the text, which may actually be in the middle of a paragraph? Anyway, I draw the lines. I circle the buts to see where the drama and how the language is working. Then I start to pay attention to the repetitions. I look for example, for the repetitions that are going to develop into image patterns and what critics call symbols. Once I see something starting to really shape up into a pattern, then I go back to the first place I found it, and I mark the page number of the next instance.
Okay.
And then I go ahead to the next instance, and I put the first page number, and then I put the next page number.
Okay.
And so that at the end, the last mention of the pattern, I'll have all the page numbers where the pattern has appeared in the book. So that then I can go back through the book and read only the image pattern.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
See, and most people reading can't get that level of control over the pattern in their heads. They only remember that it repeated a few times. But if then,
right,
if
I've seen this before, it might register.
Right,
yeah.
I've seen this before, I know it means something, I think it means this. That's not a very good
reading.
Not a very close reading. But if you've got all the places where it's mentioned on one margin, then you can go back and just read for the pattern and read exactly what the author put in next to the pattern, the associations and such. The book just suddenly opens up. The first time I did this was with Margaret Atwood's Cat's Eye.
Mm, I love that book.
Which, I mean, essentially reading that book taught me how to run image patterns. I think I'd been doing them before, but suddenly they became very conscious in my mind.
Now, a book like that, and I think the images were a lot of, like eye-type things
The cat's eye is the root image.
Right.
And then
marbles
eyes,
and
cat's eye marble. See, it starts with the cat's eye, which is a marble. It's a cat's eye marble.
Okay. Her brother's.
Her brother gives it to her.
Okay.
And she keeps it in a jar of marbles that he gave her. It's called a jar of light. He turns into a physicist who studies light.
Mm. Okay. Was their father also a scientist who had jars of light?
Oh, no. It's just a brilliant scene.
Yeah.
Where, because she knows how to just elaborate these patterns. So she's got, but first of all, it starts out, the cat's eye marble.
Uh-huh.
And then we have eyes and cat's eyes. She has a radio that repeats with a dial that glows green like a cat's eye.
Okay.
And then we have glow and green, by the way, that goes on. And then she goes into her father's, he's a biologist, zoologist, kind of like her real father, actually. She's playing a little game there. And she goes into his lab at the university, and it's a room full of jars of eyeballs.
Okay, that's,
oh,
I knew there
my
was a
God,
scene.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah,
and then you compare that with other things. There's a brilliant scene in one of the Alien movies.
Yeah, I love the Alien movies. Actually, I love the first two Alien movies.
Well, it's one of the later ones where there's all the hybrid. They use the DNA, and they're trying to create all these Ripleys, and there's this room full of glass jars of these half strange mutant beings, and it's like, it made me think of cat's eye.
Of cat's eye.
It's the image replicated in various ways, but just dumped on the watcher reader.
Yeah,
it's gorgeous stuff. But then, and then she does with that. I mean, if you read just for the pattern of the cat's eye, the book is broken. And this is Margaret Atwood's cat's eye. There's the cat's eye marble, and all these other patterns that come out of that. But the cat's eye marble is hers. At the age of 9, she has a nervous breakdown and basically kind of represses and denies all her childhood and becomes a painter. And the cat's eye marble is lost. At the end of the novel, she's rummaging through the attic of the old house and she finds in a trunk full of family memorabilia, memories, in the attic, a red heart-shaped purse she had when she was 9, her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And inside the heart-shaped purse is the cat's eye marble.
Mm.
So that the book is about her recovering her past, her
mm-hmm.
childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the image is about her losing the cat's eye marble and finding it inside her heart in a trunk full of family memories. And I just thought, you know, there's something incredibly masterful and beautiful about that writing.
I do have to wonder, when you look at a book like that and you spend time studying it and you find all of these wonderful, beautiful things, do you think that she, on first draft, is aware of what she's doing, or do you think most of that happens on revision?
Well, who's to say about her?
About her, but okay.
But,
so
because
how about
a bit, and that's
you,
a, that's
Doug
a,
Glover.
No,
are
no,
you?
And no, but I can answer about her. I mean, that's a later book. But if you look at almost all her books, they are constructed around image patterns. I mean, right, going back to The Edible Woman,
mm-hmm.
which is about a woman with anorexia, and at the end of the novel, she's eating a cake, which is made in the image of a naked woman.
Okay.
So
she's aware of this stuff right from the start.
She knows at some level what she's doing right from the very beginning. And, you know, Life Before Man is about dinosaurs and anyway, and so on. So, but to say that she plans it out right from the beginning, no, probably not. But she has a general idea of how this works.
Yeah.
She has a general idea of where the image pattern will be found and go. I do know that I read somewhere that she said that there's this thing, if you know how to do image patterning, you repeat the image and then you load it with meaning in mm-hmm. certain clear ways. It's actually
right, put it in the heart purse.
Right. No, that's something else. You load it with image, like it's kept in a jar of light, which is connected with the brother, and so on. So you know how it's going to run, and then there's another technique which I call tie-in lines, that you start the pattern, then you splinter off other patterns that are connected to it. So we have the cat's eye, then cat's eyes, light, green glow, and so on. These other things, and just eyeballs.
Okay.
You know, these things all splinter off, and they also run as separate patterns through the book. The great thing is that then at a certain point you can start doing tie-in lines where you write lines that fit in the scene realistically, but also bring together two or more of the separate lines again.
Okay.
And that's what she's doing. It's a beautiful tie-in because what she has is she has the heart-shaped person. She brings everything back together at the end.
Yeah.
And so you see people doing that. And I know I read somewhere in an interview with her, which has since been lost out of my life, that just before she sends the book off to her editor at the end, she spends a few days just going back in and doing tie-in lines. She doesn't call them that. But she goes back in and writing in lines that connect separate patterns. So she's very self-conscious at a certain point about making those patterns strong and unified.
Okay. And she's probably good at doing it subtly.
Yeah, but you know, it's really interesting reading her books. For example, Cat's Eye, just to me, after you see it very clearly, it trembles on the edge of being what one might call experimentally extrapolated. There's so much patterning there that I also wait, how do ordinary readers miss that?
Yeah.
And how do they not see that they're in control of such a masterful artist that they're not being allowed, you know, there's no room for interpretation here. It's all right there. She's very cunning. I love her work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just admire her artistry. But myself, you know, I mean, I've gotten so that I know how to do this. And so very often I just start something up and I know it's going to be a pattern that's going to repeat. I mean, I was fairly self-conscious in my novel, The Life and Times of Captain N, that the main image is the whirlwind mask. And I knew that was going to be the main image. And pretty much from the start, I was putting that everywhere in the book. And then splitting off other patterns like mask, and the Iroquois word for mask is face, and so faces and split faces and split and whirl. It's called the whirlwind mask, so the word whirlwind, concept whirlwind, whirls through the book.
Okay.
And then as I got through towards the end, I started writing tie-in lines, and then doing the tie-in lines is fun because then you try to see how many you can sneak in without, you know, as you say, letting the reader see it.
Right.
And I know Atwood can get a four, and I've gotten fours, which is you get four separate patterns back in a sentence. I've gotten four in it. I think I've managed to get four patterns in a six-word sentence. You know, and these are just really fun things to do that speak to the, you know, they promote the organic unity of the text in a way that is mostly, you know, passed over by the ordinary reader.
When you read a book that doesn't necessarily do this. Maybe it's a well-written book, but it doesn't have image patterns and it doesn't have repetitions, and you're looking for them and they just aren't there. Do you feel like that author failed in some way?
No, I do realize that there's a certain element of taste involved in how much you do this. And I always, you know, caution students that when I teach them how to do this technique, that they have to read authors and see how the actual presentation is often quite varied. And so there will be authors that go beyond, like Atwood is on the kind of cusp of going over the edge, mm-hmm. into what would then be experimental or metafictional. You know, it would, the text would be foregrounding its artifice. And lots of writers do that and are wonderful. And then there's lots of writers who don't do that, who don't have much image patterning and don't present this as an extravaganza of words. And that's okay. So, you know, it's like you write a text that's a certain sort of text.
Right.
And it could be fine in itself.
Yeah.
So I don't judge on quantity.
Okay.
Quantity is the wrong way to look at it.
All right.
It's always the quality of the text in and of itself.
Okay.
As a writer, I enjoy doing this myself.
Yeah.
But that said, the novel I just finished doesn't have that much of it.
The novel that you just finished writing?
Just finished writing, yes.
Okay.
That I just finished. So it turned out to be a book that was not necessarily going to be organized around an image pattern, whereas my other two books have a lot of that.
All right.
My other two novels.
And we've talked about globs, and we've talked about image patterns and repetition, which I think are big subjects for you. And there's another one that I really want to get to because it's a very big subject for you, and that's butt constructions.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, when you refer to a butt construction, I think that you're talking about something that's sort of at the sentence level, but you also talk about it on a larger scale, too.
Right.
So can we just talk about that?
Right. Well, the, first of all, the idea is a but construction is not a facetious coinage of mine.
I know.
The students always smirk because they think B-U-T-T. And I think there is actually a really good technical word for that. But all I mean by that is a sentence or a paragraph that turns on a but or a cognate, such that you have a statement, and then that word but, and then a counter statement or a contrasting statement or a statement that subverts the first statement. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't have to be the word but. There's all kinds of other words that we use that way. But the word but is in fact one of the most useful things. And what I found with really good writing, and to a certain extent it was Robert Louis Stevenson and Alice Munro who taught me this stuff. I began to really see that in good writing, that there's always a fight going on, that there's always a conflict, that there's always some level of statement and anti-statement, and that the bubbling energy of the prose often comes from just that. So how can you write a story or an essay or a piece of writing about somebody sleeping doing nothing? Okay, constant student problem. And I say you need more action, and the student says, oh, you mean you want me to have somebody hit somebody or you want sex? They used to think that I always wanted them to put a sex scene. I said, no, put in a but construction. You know, get some argument going on. Get some contrast in the language itself. Make the scene effervesce with thought action, grammatical action. And that really, it to me, ended up being really interesting. You look at Alice Munro, and she'll have double butts. It's like the sentence is like a skier going down a hill. It starts off in one direction and then slants back the other way, and then she'll put another butt in and she'll slant back the other way. So that there's this tremendous movement of whatever it is, meaning or vectors of meaning or value in the sentence itself, and that'll just be in the middle of a paragraph in which she's also doing that with other things. She, for example, never leaves a character in a sentence by herself. It's always one character contrasted with another character, uh-huh. or contrasted with herself as a younger person. She's always creating, I mean, I say facetiously, she's always creating a fight at the level of the words.
Yes.
And she doesn't just do it with the word but. She often uses M dashes, to
right.
parentheticals, to create subversive material within, or argumentative material within the sentence.
Right.
Or she may not do it in a sentence, but the paragraph will turn on a but. And then you look at poetry, and poetry is doing this all the time. There's always some sort of contrast of but. So in that essay that's in Copula Spiders, the essay called The Drama of Grammar, mm-hmm. I do Munro, Stevenson, and then Thomas Wyatt's poem, They Flee From Me.
Okay.
Just the things that we've been talking about. You look at Thomas Wyatt's poem, They Flee From Me, and it's what it is a group of then-now constructions and but constructions. That's all that poem is. Then-now, but, then-now. It's gorgeous. I mean, you start looking at these and how the techniques work and how they're sort of stuck in a modular way. And then you sort of wonder, you look at that and you say, God, the emotion that he got out of that, the complex, the compression of time, the compression in change of emotion that takes place in that poem. And you think, oh, that's what art is. And how is art done? It's done with these devices, which are devices at one level of conflict and on another level of concision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what you find, the difference between student prose and masterful, well-written prose, in many ways is a density of reference and action that is going on. The good prose uses these devices to pack in material, various sorts of material, and create a unity out of that's organic. The student stories, as I say in the essays, there are often read like sketches for stories.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very precise. They don't have much various bits of material in there. They're not very concrete, and we don't know what emotions are being adumbrated.
So what would you say to the student who has that sort of story and turns it in? Is it just you have not worked on this long enough? You wrote something and then you didn't finish it? You didn't complete
No, I don't think it's just a matter of rewriting, because then you get the poor students rewriting, and the thing doesn't improve.
Okay.
It's a different kind of work that you have to be available to. And the first, this comes back to what we're talking about right at the beginning. The first thing is they have to read better. Because what's going on is that they are coming at this piece of writing with unconscious assumptions about what that piece of writing should be. Student A writes a short story. Student A thinks this is what a short story is, actually.
Okay.
They often think they're quite good, right?
Right.
And they think they're the same as what Tolstoy was writing when he was writing The Death of Ivan Illich. Okay, it's a short story about a guy dying.
And I know all those words.
And so I've written that. But what they haven't seen is the incredible compression, the amount of detail, the amount of contrast of material, of conflict at the level of sentences and emotion and so on and so forth, that he manages to put in there using all these sort of devices and
mm-hmm.
techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they need to do is step back and just learn how to do some of this stuff and rewrite from that.
Yeah.
We've been concentrating on the more writing-related elements at the beginning, but the book is meant to be sort of an experience, that is, and it starts with these fairly simplistic model essays on how to write a short story and how to write a novel.
Uh-huh.
But as I say, they're really meant to be lessons in how to read, initially how to start to read a story and how to start to read a novel. And then the later essays, many of the later essays are about particular authors, and they're examples of readings.
Right.
And they're examples of reading for technique of various sorts. And so the book kind of moves through various approaches in some ways, because, for example, when I talk about the Mark Anthony Jarman story, I really lean heavily on classical rhetoric, the devices of classical rhetoric, which he uses riotously. And in his case, he doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, he doesn't know the names of the things that he's using. That's kind of interesting, because he has somehow, and that I talk about it at the end, in his reading and in his social, in his cultural background, he somehow managed to steep himself, and I think it's partly because he's Irish. His background is Irish. And the Irish speak in a rhetorical fashion,
okay,
in a way.
Right.
As do South Americans from the South. There's some patches where that kind of rhetorical structure has existed, stayed in the local language in a way that's very interesting.
Yeah.
There's that, and then I go on to other novels and essays and talk about their structure and the devices. Alice Munro's story, where I talk a lot about time structure and image,
yeah,
patterning there,
yeah,
and Thomas Bernhard and so on and so forth. And then the book then even leans farther away into the idea of history, cultural anthropology even, and the ideology of form at the end of the book. So that the book is sort of this experience that leads you into a larger and larger meditation on what form is. It starts out with a very simplistic idea of what form is, and then through the experience of reading,
right,
you get a larger and larger and actually sort of more mysterious and an open-ended idea of what form is.
And less prescriptive.
Oh, actually. Absolutely. The whole point is that it's not prescriptive.
Right.
It's a meditation on what form is, which, to me, form is this incredibly beautiful and mysterious thing, which many readers have learned sort of intuitively, because we know what a good book is as we read it,
mm-hmm,
at some level.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, is sort of amazingly interesting. Where do we learn that? How do we learn that? What is the cultural imperative that has led us to that?
Mm-hmm.
And then I speculate upon that.
I want to just read a couple of quotes and get your reactions to them. And I thought of these quotes. I was familiar with these two authors' works. And after reading this line in your book, I thought of these other author's lines. So you write, "The very fact that a story is a neat package implies the somewhat doubtful premise that the world comes to us in neat packages." All right? And that reminded me a little bit of E.M. Forster's Aspects of the Novel. He writes, "Novels, even when they are about wicked people, can solace us. They suggest a more comprehensive and thus a more manageable human race. They give us the illusion of perspicacity and of power." And then Julia Alvarez wrote in an essay, "Perhaps we love good novels and poems And then this is the quote, because we can enter without shame or without encountering defensiveness or embarrassment the intimate lives of other people. So I don't know why, but I thought these were related ideas, the idea of a neat package and how novels kind of deliver to us something that we can understand, whereas real life, it's too big. So
yes, that's really, in many ways, the point of the last essay of the in the book. And I had forgotten.
The best title of all time, Don Quixote, Rosemary's Baby, Alien, and the French Lieutenant's Woman, Meditations on the Ideology of Closure and the Comforting Lie.
Yes, I did like that. I like that. I had forgotten that Forrester quote. When you think about form in general, and even, you know, as Aristotle said, the form is, at one level is the beginning, a middle, and an end. And it is a package right from the beginning. We think of form, we think of storytelling, we think of art as a package. The painting is in a frame.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there is artificial. Form is always artificial. So, but then you have to say, well, what else do we have? Well, we don't have anything else. And this is the mystery of art. It's the mystery of language, actually, to begin to... Language pigeonholes everything you talk about. You put a word on it, and all of a sudden it's no more than that word.
That word.
And so language right there limits us and cuts us off from reality, cuts us off from the world. Mm-hmm. Form cuts us off from reality.
Right. Woody Allen said something like, the best works he's ever created, he never actually created. They were just in his head.
Right, because the best works would be kind of endless and limitless in some way. Because those would be the ones that had the mimetic quality that actually really did imitate life. So we have this thing that we use and we love, and we say that we're getting at reality with this novel or this, and it's just not true, is it? So, and that's a mystery to me. That's not a critique or anything to me. It's an endless mystery, and it works in with the way endings work and the way ideology in general works. And I think that in America and as elsewhere, that often art is used, especially in our world right now, where the media is sort of exponentially taking over consciousness in a way, that even art is used to promote an ideology, whatever ideology that is, some real underlying ideology. And so then in that essay, I'm just saying, hey, people, just watch how you end things and watch how great books end and think about how many authors try very hard to subvert the fact that they're ending something, that Tolstoy at the end of War and Peace, huge, brilliant novel, sticks in a 50-page essay about the philosophy of history and tells a little bit about his characters after the novel, which subverts the ending of the novel. Which is a marriage ending,
right?
And so, which the marriage ending, of course, he knows that's the end of a romantic novel, or a novel. It's not a romantic novel, but it's the end of that novel. It has to be a marriage, right?
Right.
And Shakespeare puts lots of marriages at the ends of his comedies and stuff like that. But Tolstoy knows that that's a false ending. And you look at the end of Heart of Darkness, one of those little books that just grows and grows and grows on you. Marlowe goes home to Kurtz's widow and tells her a lie.
Right.
The ending has to be a lie. Otherwise, it wouldn't be palatable to the reader in some way.
So is your message to your readers of this book about endings that they should understand the implications their endings have for the larger work?
Right. I think at some level, it's very good to be aware of what... To think about form, think what form is, and think how form constrains you. There's no way of getting out of form, except that then you can sort of invent ways of getting out of it, of trying to get out of it, or giving the reader a little flag and saying, I know, it's an ending, but it's not real. And also to be aware in your reading, you know, how conscious is the author of what the author is telling us in this nice little happy ending, like, you know, all those books about coming to terms with that parent you rebelled against, mother, daughter, father, son novels where everybody ends up meeting happily at the end, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, don't give me that crap.
Don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's just to make us feel good about things that are often unbearably non-ending.
Right.
So just think about what's happening here. I'm writing this novel. I'm making this package. How do I want to end it that will be wise and aware?
So like John Fowles in The French Lieutenant's Woman, you mentioned how he gives us two endings.
He gives two endings to let you know that the ending is up for grabs here.
Which Tim O'Brien does too in The Lake of the Woods.
That's a really interesting book structurally and technically. And of course he knows. He's warring against form in that book, and very knowingly, mm-hmm. which is interesting. I mean, I never quite figured out how he figured that out. Mm-hmm. I actually interviewed him for my radio show about that book.
Oh, wow.
And we had an interesting conversation about it. But yeah, no, that's a really interesting and kind of unique book in American literature. Slightly irritating, too, because on another level it's a little superficial, because he just says, any of these things could have happened. So then that becomes a kind of facile message about reality.
Right.
So I don't know, I had a little mixed feelings. But it's a very, 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 very cagey and interesting book.
Yeah. Okay, well, so my last question has to do with copula spiders, the subject of the title of the book. In reading student work, you sometimes circle all the to-be verbs on a student page and then connect them with lines and draw a spider to visually represent the overuse of the verb to be. And in the book you write, the verb to be doesn't tell a story. So I wondered if you could talk about that and also talk about precise verbs.
Okay, that's a good question, because, of course, what is a copula spider? And a copula spider is one of these things that I invented as a...
I was going to say, what is a copula?
What is a copula spider? First of all, hardly anybody uses that word copula anymore, so it's a little... it's a connecting verb. And there are other verbs that are copulas, but to be is the most... is the one that's the most used. But what I noticed about student writing... Once again, I'm looking at the student writing and saying, now why... You know, I'm puzzling over it, and I'm saying, why isn't this page of writing as good as Tolstoy or Jennifer Egan or whoever would want to say? And again, I'm sort of saying, it doesn't seem to have much detail. It doesn't seem to have much action. And then I start to notice that there's a certain kind of monotony in the verb choices. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed, of course, that the one word that keeps coming up over and over again is the verb to be. And so I used to start circling the verb to be, and then I would circle more and more of them. And then idly I started drawing lines between them, and I said, oh, it looks like a spider. And I thought, well, the spider is taken. So I would draw these things, and I would just say copula spider, and then I have to teach the student, when I can do this on your page, it means that you can improve the quality of writing by going through and changing at least some of those verbs to good concrete action verbs. And right there, then you get action on the page by changing the verb. And so I did that, and then it expands into a larger lesson in the text, in the chapter in the book, about verb choice in general, because after to be, the next verbs that students lean on most are verbs like look, move, sit, stand, stare. And boy, I'm working today, you know, I'm going through a page and sort of finding the verb to look used four times in a page. And if that's the most popular verb in your lexicon, then you are, you know, letting yourself down in some way. If you lean on these verbs, you're not telling much of a story. Okay. And if you look at Alice Munro, and so then I have this famous counting thing that it's facetious again, but it's also meant to dramatize the lesson. If you count the words in a paragraph or on a page, and then count the number of times you use to be or some generic verb, and how many times you actually use a very good, strong, active verb, mm-hmm. and you compare the ratios in your work or Alice Munro's work and so on, then you'll see that Alice Munro has many more strong verbs than you do. And that's a way of improving your writing. It's a way of reading and comparing what you're doing. Students have a hard time reading in the sense of comparing what they're doing with what another writer is doing and learning from that.
And finding the stronger verbs, I would think, will also change the sentence structure and make things a little more interesting on other levels. Is that right?
That is, in fact, the tricky thing, because once you start changing a sentence to make it better, then you have to change the sentences around it. You can't just change the verb to be. You have to change the sentence structure. It demands writing from you. It demands that you create. The word verb to be is, as I say, it's just a connector. It just says this is this. And then to create an active sentence, then you have to put another verb in, and that requires more detail. It requires an agent, requires a character to do something. And who? Why would that character do? All kinds of things begin to come into that sentence. And then if you have one nice sentence, then that doesn't look good next to these other drab sentences. So then rewriting becomes this sort of crystallizing. I envision it as a kind of process of crystals growing on the page, because you change one sentence, and then the sentences around it have to change, and that crystalline structure of better sentences gradually spreads over the
spreads out.
And the copula spider disappears, and all of a sudden you've got this text full of really nice, interesting sentences.
I'm curious if the verb to feel is one of those generic words that you tell people to watch out for.
That's an interesting question, because in fact, on one level, students don't use that one enough.
Oh.
Because that speaks to another technical issue.
Okay.
Which is the how to express emotion.
Yeah.
And student writers are incredibly restrained and inhibited about expressing emotion. So
are you mostly talking about undergraduate students at that point?
No, graduate students.
Everybody.
Okay. You can have a PhD in English literature, and I'm still teaching you to do this stuff. And have.
No, but I mean, as far as expressing emotion, do you find that to be more true of the younger students,
I think
is what I'm saying? No.
Absolutely not.
Okay, interesting.
Absolutely not. Mm. I mean, I'm just working on a student work today. It's a man. He's in his late 30s, and he comes to a point where he's got to express emotion, and what he says is his hands clenched. He felt sweat on his brow, and I'm sitting there saying, well, that's very low-level emotional expression. You know, that's not showing your chops here.
And although then, it is showing and not telling.
Well, but here we should be telling. I mean, here we should be feeling. I felt we might actually be very useful
there.
Yes.
Because sometimes.
Or no, not necessarily be better, but I have these emotional symptoms, and I feel you do a hybrid. Emotional expression is often good in hybrid sentences or hybrid constructions, where you have a physical manifestation and then a feeling sentence.
Okay. All right.
And then a but construction. No, really, I'm not, you know, you make it interesting. It's not like I just felt anger. I felt, you know, this anger coming up. But then I looked at her, and how could I be angry at her? She's a little 90-year-old woman, and yet she just infuriated me. See, two buts.
Okay, okay.
An emotional expression and so on. You see how you start futzing with this stuff and thinking about it as an exercise in applying a technique.
Yeah. Great. All right. The book is Attack of the Copula Spiders by Douglas Glover, published by Biblioasis. And thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with the author Douglas Glover. As I just said at the end of the interview, that he is the author of Attack of the Copula Spiders, Essays on Writing, published by Biblioasis. You can learn more about Doug at his website, douglasglover.net. And he also founded the online magazine Numero Cinque, which is a really interesting place to go and look at works of writing and conversations about writing. Early in his essay collection, Doug Glover asserts this about point of view in fiction. He writes, "Point of view is the mental modus operandi of the person who is telling or experiencing the story. Most often, this is the protagonist. This mental modus operandi is located in a fairly simple construct involving desire, significant history, and language overlay. The writer generally tries to announce the desire, goal, or need of the primary character as quickly as possible. The key here is to make this desire concrete and simple." And he goes on. But this week, for your Write the Book prompt, I'm going to ask you to look at the point of view in a piece that you're working on and ask yourself, is this character's desire clear? Is it concrete and simple? Do I introduce it quickly enough for readers to understand? And how might I improve on the early presentation of my point of view character? So, good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.